Because it had to be funny, it had to be sexy, and it had to be useful. And if you think about those three things, that is the internet in embryo.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Cynical Voices, the media-focused podcast that takes a wry look at all the news and views. Sorry, Media Voices, that takes a wry look at all the news and views from the media world this week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Our designated uncynical person for the week.
I'm never cynical, me. Before we get to the cynicism, that quote you just heard was from Ed Needham, who single-handedly puts together Strong Words magazine. He writes about 100 book reviews for every issue. We spoke about his previous life in men's magazines, FHM and Maxim, managing editor role at Rolling Stone, including lunch with Bono, who's not as much of a numpty as you might think, apparently. There's that cynicism already. And how different all that is from his current solo gig.
Before that fantastic interview, we're going to take that tour through this week's news, as we promised. And the lead story this week is that Google, finally, solving all the world's ills, is going to start paying some publishers to license their content. So after years of publishers asking for it, most publishers, Google has decided to start paying some publishers to license their content for a new product set to launch later this year. And at the time, Google's VP of Product Management for News said, "We've heard loud and clear that we need to do more to support publications around the world. Today's news is part of that solution." So I suppose that's the end of Media Voices, really, because all the problems have been taken care of.
Absolutely. As a designated optimist for today, yeah, great news. Well done, Google. You've been listening. Well done.
Ah, but wait. Okay, so Sarah Fisher reporting for Axios has basically broken this down into two parts. So the first is that Google is going to pay select publishers to distribute their work, you know, whether that's video, audio, images, or text, as part of this new news product. Details of which haven't yet been made public.
That's okay. They're working on it.
Sure. Okay. All right. But also the second part is that Google is also going to offer to pay for free access for users to read paywalled articles on a publisher's site where available, with the aim to help those publishers grow their audiences.
Excellent.
Yeah, great. Except, so...
It's good... No. I don't know where to start.
It's good, so, no.
My feeling is that this is a bit of a move to appease the... So there's been this growing movement, you know, we've had France, we've had Australia and a lot of others in this kind of war to get Google to start paying publishers for directing clicks to their websites, which is
nonsense.
It's a wrong movement. It's not going to work. It is so flawed, and that is a separate argument we've covered many, many times. So they kind of said, right, okay, rather than get into that argument, because that's really, really complicated, we're going to create like this dedicated news product. And honestly, from everything they said, I'm not actually sure they know what that's going to look like. I think it's one of the things, if they'd said, you know, if they didn't have Google News and they said, we're going to release a new app that's going to look a bit like Apple News and we're going to pay publishers to license content in it, that would work. But they've not kind of said how this is sitting alongside Google News and just how all that's going to work, how the licensing is going to work. And it seems to me they've just kind of put this statement out just to take the heat off a little bit with all of these legal battles going on with France and Australia.
Oh, you two are so cynical.
And as we mentioned in the daily newsletter where we flagged this up for the first time, I think it was on Thursday, we said Google can just, they can turn off products like this like that.
I mean, they did. They essentially had like basically a newspaper product that they killed off about 3 or 4 years ago.
I still miss Google Plus.
I've got a non-cynical line.
Okay.
Go on.
Google have put a lot of money into the news industry, and you know the
have these all?
And the grants over the last couple of years. I mean, oh come on, it's tiny changes.
Yeah, so that's not a lot then, is it? Well, since when is tiny and a lot the same thing?
It's tiny to them. It's a lot to.
It's relative, isn't it? Yeah. I agree.
Nice
I
think try, that, Esther.
No, I sort of agree. I think Google is doing, even if it is a bit of lip service, they are at least putting some resource into this. And it's nice when publishers' priorities align with Google's. They align with Google's a lot more than they do with Facebook's. But the problem is that they don't align completely. And so anything like this, it just has that potential to be either turned off or perverted or just not work for publishers.
I suppose this is going to be one of the biggest questions I've got around this is, and it, you know, it's the same question Facebook stumbled over, is how are they going to decide who and what ends up in that? You know, is it just going to be the Washington Post, the New York Times, Breitbart?
Yeah. See, no.
There's a sentence that we didn't expect on Media Voices.
No, but she's just... right. She's 100% right. Because high quality is in the eye of the beholder. Google cannot afford bad press from either the right wing or the left. They will have highly polemic publishers in there under the guise of being high quality. It's fake balance. It's fake objectivity. It's not a solution. It's kicking the can down the road.
Okay.
If they only pay some publishers, you're going to have this question again about who absolutely gets paid.
That is absolutely right. So, go back to your click thing.
Mm.
Why can't you have like a reverse pay-per-click thing?
Okay.
Where you actually get paid for clicks through Google to news content. Why does that not work?
Right. Joshua Benton has written a fantastic piece that basically takes this down again this week. I've lost track of how many times it's been taken down. So he actually pointed out that, like, if... I'm trying to think how to phrase this. He said that if you pay for news in any systemic way, it attacks their core advantage as platforms, which is essentially organising other people's content. So they say if they pay the New York Times for including their stories in search, and I've got a really old blog post that also appears in search, or a tweet that appears in search, or, you know, a product that appears in search, do we also get paid? It's very, very difficult to draw a line between this is a news publisher that we're going to pay and this is, like,
but why,
the rest of the internet.
So why not everyone?
You couldn't possibly pay the billions and billions of websites that they index. They index that as a service. Like,
okay,
these websites won't get found if
people fair enough. So then why not have some kind of baseline qualification that people have to meet before they can register to get paid?
Because that then gets highly political.
No, it doesn't. No, because it can be based on...
Peter, wearing a mask is political. Everything's going to get politicised.
I mean, we've got, you know, if you look at verification on any platform, like, verification is an absolute minefield. Because under any of those systems, Breitbart classifies as a publisher.
But that's okay.
So does Ben Shapiro.
It's you've just broke my argument.
No, again, Joshua Benton does break this down really well. He says, yeah, if you start paying people by popularity and by the way that they serve the platform, you end up with the Daily Mail, Breitbart, and all these other places that essentially end up really massively benefiting from that, because it drives this whole clicks and outrage and
I tried here.
I appreciate you trying. I do appreciate you trying.
Well, isn't that the other thing that Joshua Benton said, that this is a PR exercise?
Oh, it is a PR. It 100% is. It's, they wouldn't have announced it as they did with this, with no detail, if it weren't.
Yeah, it's literally so that, you know, when Australia hauls them up in, what is it, round three of their legal battle, they say, oh, look, we are actually
We're doing it. Well, there we go. So, I think ultimately it's easy to be cynical. And it's correct, but
what? It's really hard to be not cynical.
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to get any less cynical now, are we?
No, and also I think that realistically we need to put a pin in this one and say, let's come back to it when we have more detail.
Yeah, let's give Google the benefit of the doubt, guys.
Good, good. I'm glad we're all on the same page. Hey, also on the same page, a vast array of some of the biggest advertisers in the world are pulling spend from social over quote-unquote harmful content concerns.
Point of order.
Go on.
Have I still got to be optimistic?
No. I'll take Christ for that. Let me tag in. I'll be the optimist this time.
I just don't believe in it. That's bullshit. It's just nonsense.
So, I mean, we covered this quite extensively over the last few weeks. Social media platforms and Trump and various other political systems have been in various fights about what they're allowed to say, what they're taking down, whether they put Nazi Germany symbols up against... Sorry. Where they put Nazi symbols up against their advertising content. All fairly uncontroversial stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, because there's been a bit of an outcry over this, it's Verizon, Unilever, Coca-Cola joined on Friday, have said that they're pulling ad spend from Facebook and Twitter. Coca-Cola's actually said they're pausing advertising across all social platforms over content moderation policies. So Verizon specifically cited Facebook's policing information about Black Lives Matter protests and Trump as two reasons that they were pausing this. But I was under the impression advertisers weren't spending that much at the moment anyway.
Well, this is that's exactly it. This is, I think, another one where they go, you know what, we're not spending anyway, let's get some moral money here. Let's get some goodwill dollars from the commentators by going, you know what, we weren't going to be spending anyway, but we're not doing it now specifically because of free speech issues.
And do you know what gets me about all of this the most? Is that they're still all spending on Instagram and that's still going to Zuckerberg's pockets.
Yeah, a lot of them are. A lot of them are. Not all. I think a few of them have specifically said Instagram as well.
There's an actual impact for Facebook in this. The stock dropped some mad amount. I saw a number, it was like $50 billion or something.
Yeah, I think it's only the GDP of most of the EU now, rather than most of Europe as a whole.
So it is having an impact, but it's under the Stop for Hate or Stop Hate for Profit hashtag.
Mm-hmm.
So that the fact that it is a wrapper and that it's being done for the reasons that you said is interesting, and yet it did cost Facebook and Zuckerberg some money.
Two wrongs made a right.
I think I've got a slightly non-cynical line to this.
Oh, yes, go for that.
And that is that we did actually see this, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, when advertisers, do you remember they all pulled out of YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
And they all said, until YouTube can sort out, like, not surfacing child pornography and conspiracy theories, we're not going to advertise on it anymore. It was pretty much the same group of people. I think P&G were huge in it as well. And Verizon have cited this again, that they said that we're pausing our advertising on Facebook until they can create an acceptable solution that makes us comfortable and is consistent with what we've done with YouTube and other partners. So this has worked before, and YouTube is now slightly less bad at surfacing garbage.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that the recent baby steps that we've seen from Twitter and Facebook around, you know, preventing that kind of stuff? We only spoke, it was in the week we were talking about Facebook's, you know, labelling of any content that's over 90 days to prevent the sharing of misinformation. Do you think that was specifically driven to try to get out ahead of this and they just didn't do it in time?
I think anything they do at this point is to try and get out ahead of the criticism that they know is coming.
So what I don't understand is why is everybody turning on Twitter all of a sudden? Because I thought they were pretty good the last 6 months.
Me too, actually. I think this is unfair on Twitter. I think this is potentially these advertisers not keeping up with the changes that Twitter has made. I know that they have significant problems and they are endemic in a lot of ways, but they have been making changes.
Or is it because they're using this as a smokescreen for cutting their advertising budgets?
Yeah, it could be that. It could be that too.
Yeah, great. This boycott could be interesting, but publishers need to step into the gap and pick up that, brand safe environments. You know, again, being cynical, if the reason is they don't want to advertise during a pandemic, then they're never going to spend that money with magazines. But not anything that makes Facebook sort out some of the crap on Facebook. So, news in brief after that. BuzzFeed has fired one of its remaining reporters. Ryan Broderick has been fired over plagiarism concerns. I haven't really seen that much about this. What's the story?
So 11 articles have now been flagged on BuzzFeed News for not adhering to their high standards. Effectively, it is plagiarism. It's been going on for quite some time.
BuzzFeed can't catch a break, though.
No, they can't.
Oh, dear. Or BuzzFeed News, anyway.
I thought this next one was interesting. So Netflix's commissioning model, effectively by, I think, the end of the first quarter, it had its entire 2020 slate set and ready to air at specific dates. So its commissioning model had effectively inoculated its production process against COVID-19. And so the next time we talk about things like, you know, oh, well, you know, X number of people have an entertainment subscription versus news, you got to remember that they're just wholly different products with wholly different business models. And ultimately, they're not comparable.
Bauer UK is sadly set to close magazine titles that it says are unlikely to be sustainable after COVID-19. So Planet Rock, Simply You and Practical Photography will all publish their final issues in July. Bauer's been cutting a lot worldwide, hasn't it? It's been quite brutal.
This Ben Shapiro story, have you seen this? Do you know who Ben Shapiro is?
So you two flagged this for me this week, and I read it. I vaguely knew who Ben Shapiro is, but I didn't know his brand almost. I knew him more as a personality. So what the f*** is this story?
Well, he runs this right-wing news site, The Daily Wire. This story, and it's an insane investigation, insanely, insanely detailed investigation on his traffic by the guys at this popular information site, which I guess is a fairly small site. And they've gone through, I think it's maybe Chartbeat's numbers.
Yeah.
And they figured out that Ben Shapiro's traffic he gets more traffic than like the New York Times on Facebook. And the reason is, and this is the scary part, because he's got some kind of relationship with these other right-wing head cases who run something called Mad World News and even the names of these sites, Mad World News, The New Resistance, Right Stuff, America First, American Patriot. I mean, you can just imagine the content on American Patriot.
The American Patriot, Jesus Christ. Geez. If I had to come up with a parody name for a conservative news site, I couldn't do better than that.
But anyway, every time Ben Shapiro's site, The Daily Wire, puts out a story, these other sites fire out like 10 Facebook posts. Mm. And that's what's driving the engagement.
Esther, how are you going to fix that?
Turn it off and don't turn it back on again.
Yeah, don't bother turning it back on again. This week I spoke with Ed Needham, founder and editor, sole staffer of Book Review magazine Strong Words. We spoke about his previous career, his current workload, and what the future of magazines might look like. But first, we spoke about how he got started in magazines.
Well, I started in my journalistic career quite late, really. I was living in Spain until I was almost 30, and I thought 30 was, for some reason, there's something between the ages of 29 and 30, which means the shutters come down. So everything that hasn't been accomplished prior to that is never going to be accomplished. So I moved back from Spain and started freelancing for people. And that was in the mid-90s, and it was around about the time when FHM magazine had been bought by EMAP and became a more sort of mainstream magazine. And I started working for them. And that was an extraordinary piece of good luck, because that sort of whole genre of men's magazines just took off in the mid-90s. And before then, you know, magazines for men kind of assumed that men came home, marched into their drawing room, sat down in an armchair, poured themselves an expensive whiskey and got their pipe going and sat down and read Sir Walter Scott for the rest of the evening. You know, it's a very antiquated vision of how men were. And so that kind of genre of men's magazine came as a real, breath of fresh air to an audience. So that was... I was a contributor, then I became the deputy editor, then I became the editor, and that magazine just took off, you know, it went through the roof. So I remember when I joined, we kind of had a meeting. The editor then was a chap called Mike Sutar, and he said, where do we want to be in a year's time? And in a market of five men's magazines at the time, FHM was very much fifth. And we said, well, it'd be nice to be perhaps, I don't know, third would be good. But in a year later, we were out in front and selling. You know, we couldn't produce enough copies to keep newsagents happy. They were just flying out the door. And so that was an extraordinary introduction to the world of magazines. And because that was my first experience of it, really, I just assumed it was going to be like that for the rest of my life. And didn't quite turn out that way.
So after FHM, what did you do?
Well, I went to the United States and I launched FHM in America. And then I was at Rolling Stone for a couple of years. I edited Rolling Stone for 2 years. So my title was managing editor. But they were eager at the time to bring in some sort of outside experience, because I think I thought, like the rest of the magazine industry, saw these upstart magazines kind of stealing their thunder. I thought we'll have some of that. So I think that was another great stroke of good fortune that enabled me to get such a senior job at such an august and esteemed and journalistic magazine. And I did that for a couple of years, and that was like operating in a completely different market, and suddenly had access to ingredients in terms of writers and photographers of a caliber that we'd never been able to work with at FHM, and so that was an awesome experience. We also used to be able to invite all sorts of people for lunch, so we'd often have 2004 was the American presidential election. This is middle of George Bush, his second election. And because Rolling Stone was very much a sort of a pro-Democrat magazine, we had all the Democratic candidates, one after another, came for lunch. And, you know, we could ask them questions and they could tell us to lay out their sort of ideas, but also to, you know, share all sorts of extraordinarily indiscreet remarks, you know, that you wouldn't normally get from when these people are on the television. So that was great. And also, we used to have quite a lot of musicians would come for lunch. And one of the things that I learnt from that is, you know, they say you should never meet your heroes, but I think the opposite is also true, that you should meet people of whom you have a slightly low opinion, because one of the people who came for lunch was Bono, and I've never been a fan of U2, and he was, you know, he's obviously famous for getting on the soapbox, on his soapbox, and being a bit annoying, but he turned out to be just the most extraordinarily charismatic and engaging individual. And if he had said during this lunch, you know, right, we are all going to stand up now and you're going to follow me, we're going to walk into the Hudson River, you know, everybody would have followed him. It was absolutely magnificent and very sort of polite. And, you know, he wrote me a sort of thank you letter at the end of it and all these kind of things. So that was very impressive. And then I also edited Maxim for a couple of years, which at the time in America was the biggest men's magazine in the world. So that was selling, I think, about 3 million copies per month. So that was, you know, at a time when, again, we, you know, the magazine world felt like it was going to be with us for centuries to come, and nobody could see any clouds on the horizon.
What's the difference between editing something like, well, FHM and Maxim, which are relatively new to the magazine market, and something like Rolling Stone that's been going since, what, late 60s, early 70s?
I think when, you know, the real success of FHM and those, you know, slightly sort of irreverent, impertinent men's magazines was that they filled such a huge gap in the market. One day, Mike took us all off to an offsite, and he said, "Right, what's got to be in each issue? What are we making each issue out of?" And so we made these lists. You know, we've got to have a celebrity interviewer, and we've got to have a famous woman in a sort of state of semi-undress, and all that. And we've got to have some humour, and we've got to have some. And gradually it turned out that some of these things were sort of elements and some of them were more kind of themes, you know, that they could be applied to all sorts of different things. We narrowed it down and decided that actually the three things that FHM had to be made of was it had to be funny, it had to be sexy, and it had to be useful. And if you think about those three things, that is the internet in embryo, right? Funny, sexy, useful is the internet. And that's why magazines like FHM were so successful, because they deliver those things. Whereas a magazine like Rolling Stone, it's a much more sort of, obviously it has a very radical background in, you know, 1960s American counterculture. You think about all the things that are going on then when music was genuinely considered a threat to the entire fabric of the American nation. And the way in which people were behaving with drugs and taking such outrageous risks with their hair and this kind of thing was considered a real, you know, it feels kind of absurd now, but you know, social organisations, it felt like a genuine threat to the sort of social structure. And so it was very much allied also to the political counterculture. And the idea today of launching a magazine that blends music and politics is just unthinkable. You know, those two things are so far apart. But because Rolling Stone had its roots in this counterculture and took a very journalistic approach to them, you know, this is proper long-form journalism where people go away and report on stories, often for several months. You know, it had that moment of, it grasped that sort of zeitgeist element and applied very traditional journalistic repertorial skills to it. So I think that was the real magic of Rolling Stone. And, you know, people, when I was editing it, people would, drop whatever they were doing to respond to an invitation to be on the cover. So even in the 2000s.
So how'd you go from having lunch with Bono to doing strong words, which you're doing now? And yeah, I mean, it sounds a fairly solitary pursuit.
It is a very, very solitary pursuit. You know, it's Strong Words is a magazine which I do on my own. I have a designer for 2 weeks, and it works on a sort of 6 week cycle. So I produce one issue every 6 weeks. And to do that, I obviously read loads of books and write lots of words. So there's not really much time for anything else. I work 7 days a week. I used to allow myself one day off every issue. So I used to have a Sunday off once every 6 weeks, which I would use to go. I live in London, so I'd leave London and I would go walking in the countryside somewhere. But obviously now that that's become illegal, I don't do that either. So now I now work 7 days a week, every week. And during that time, I read the I worked it out. I read the equivalent of War and Peace every week. And I write the equivalent of The Great Gatsby every issue. So it's quite straightforward in that sense. It's just a, you know, large volume of work that has to be got through, the same as most other people in their jobs. But what's different from those old days is that, and it's a terrible sort of paradox or sort of situation of great unfairness, really, that, you know, the technology that has allowed people such as me to produce an entire magazine on my own. So it's cut out all those people, you know, who used to provide intermediate services, you know, pre-press and couriers delivering photographs and all these kind of things. So the technology that's enabled me to do this on my own has also simultaneously destroyed the market for so many magazines, you know, because the internet and digital amusements have replaced the, you know, taken the attention span away from the magazine audience. And once that relationship is broken, you know, people never go back. So that's the problem. But I really believe in books. I really believe that books are underserved by the media and that they have a great untapped potential. You know, they're sort of considered as a bit of a niche activity or niche source of information or an entertainment, and I think they're deserving of a great deal more exposure. And, you know, it's also that, you know, magazines are kind of the only thing I know how to do with any sort of ability. You know, I can't pilot a tugboat, or I can't, you know, produce gargoyles for cathedrals or anything, you know, whatever you choose. You know, there isn't anything else. You know, all the thousands of other jobs that people do, this is the only one that I'm really qualified to actually do with any confidence. So that's where that comes from. And I just really feel the book industry, you know, it needs a lot more exposure. It deserves a lot more exposure, and it's seen its square footage just gobbled up, as so that, you know, the attention that the numbers of pages say that the books used to get in newspapers have gradually disappeared as newspapers have shrunk and books don't get that, you know, they're not able to, the book industry isn't able to put the kind of advertising revenue behind its promotion and marketing. And so books, they just get less and less attention. So Strong Words really aims to be this, you know, the popular book magazine that when people want to know, you know, what should I read next, what is the next book for me, that they have a reliable source of that information.
So what does your day look like? Do you read a book and then write a review and then start on the next book?
Well, kind of. I mean, there's quite a lot of admin involved as well, as you might imagine, and a certain amount of research, but essentially it is lots of reading and lots of writing. But because I like walking, and I spend most nights at my girlfriend's house, which is about 6 miles away. So I walk there and listen to an audio book, and then and walk back in the morning at sort of 6 o'clock. So I do a certain amount of reading while walking, and then yeah, just get on with it. You know, all those pages need filling. So it's, yeah, it's a, most days I'll read a book and write about it. But there's quite a lot of other stuff needs doing as well. In the, you know, the elaboration of a magazine, you know, copy needs cutting, headlines need writing. I've got to plan the next issue, talk to publishers. You know,
have you ever thought about taking on staff. I saw a quote from you, actually, or it's actually not from you, it's from Felix Dennis, but you used it in an article in, I think it was a New Statesman. Felix said, overheads walk on two legs.
Yes, you know, that was one of his great mantras, you know, that staff numbers, and it used to take an awful lot of people to produce the magazine, can easily gobble up any profits that that you make. And it used to be, you know, that you needed not only your editorial staff, but then your sales staff and your marketing staff and your production staff and then all the external people. So that's kind of what he meant, I think. You know, once you add up all the numbers, you could end up, you've got, you know, easily 50, 60 mouths to feed. And so now, obviously, by doing it with just me, I have just the one mouth needs feeding. And so I would happily take on people if I were able to, you know, economically, or as if... I'm not, you know, it's not an end in itself, you know, this slightly, this sort of martyrdom of doing it all on my own. although I, you know, I do like having the sort of last word, and I would be quite happy to take on other people at some point and expand the, you know, the business, because I do think this is a model that has a great deal of potential. You know, I don't have, you know, all these sort of management people above me that need a cut. I don't have office space and receptionists that need a cut. I don't have all these external suppliers that need keeping on board. So I think it is possible to actually produce quite sophisticated magazines now without people all being in the same room and without massive sort of support staff to make it possible.
You know, I'm a big fan of that kind of indie magazine ethos, but I worry sometimes that, you know, the future of the magazines looks a bit like a farmer's market. You know, it's all people separate and doing their own thing, and no one's really got a career.
That's true, and I very much agree with that. And you asked me in those the questions that we were talking about earlier, you know, am I optimistic or pessimistic about, you know, magazine industry? And I would say I'm optimistic for my magazine, but pessimistic for a lot of other people's. Because and the, you know, when we were talking about the, you know, how the magazine industry used to be in that, you know, before the turn of the century, this magazine world was an absolutely joyous place. You know, when I was editing FHM, I was in the same corridor as all these other great magazines. And next door was Smash Hits, and next door to that was Mojo, and across the corridor was Kerrang, and next to them was Mix Mag, and downstairs was Empire and Q. And it just felt like this just pleasure factory of all these, you know, terrific people, but all in their own little spaces, you know. And so our office was very much very different to, you know, the Smash Hits office, and then beyond that the Mojo office, you know, where they would stop at 4 o'clock on the dot every day to have a different cake and, you know, sort of tea ceremony. And you know, or Smash Hits was just full of cardboard cutouts of you know, pop stars and piles of paper and people running around and everything. And every office had its own. Mixmag had their own in-house DJ, and it was, who was on the mix on the masthead, you know, somebody who was just in there all day playing records for them. And so every magazine environment had its own personality. It was a really distinct place, and that just fed so much into the voice of each magazine. You know, it was really powerful and flavoursome, and reflected the personality of all these people cooped up in the same room together. Whereas obviously, as soon as you start introducing things like hot desking and hubs and people working remotely, then all that atmosphere, you know, it just doesn't exist. It doesn't have the opportunity to take root and develop.
Well, one of the criticisms that gets levelled, particularly at the women's magazines sector at the moment, is that they're all the same. They've lost that character. You know, women's magazines, I guess, just because, you know, there still is a women's magazine market. The men's magazine market, I think, went away. But do you think, is that ever going to come back? Can it come back?
Well, I'd like to think that there are enough people who really love just the sheer joy of producing magazines, that something of that can be kept alive, you know, like a bit of ancient yeast that can be reactivated at some point and fed back in. Because I think, you know, when I think, you know, people who buy magazines really respond to those voices. But at the moment, I've also fear that the kind of headaches that magazines are facing mean that issues such as, you know, having a really strong and individual voice are so far down the list of problems to be solved that they're probably not getting the kind of attention, you know, that other really serious issues are, you know, hoovering up all the attention.
So you're working on your own mostly. How has lockdown affected you? Has it made any difference?
Well, in terms of, you know, if you imagine, you know, I'm a man on my own in a flat, sitting essentially motionless at a desk all day. Obviously, lockdown doesn't, you know, doesn't affect that. But I really miss some of the noise in the street. You know, I live in the middle of central London, and I like to hear, you know, van drivers exchanging opinions on each other's driving and this kind of thing, filtering up through the window. And that's it's starting to come back, but I just miss the sense of the city going on outside. I mean, I miss the news as well. You know, the fact that for so long, I know it's kind of changed a bit over the last week, but for so long there's absolutely no news other than sort of coronavirus numbers, and so that's a significant difference. But really, I think the big difference is the editorial I can sit and do on my own at a desk without any problems, but the marketing needs me to be able to go out. So I've really missed things like literary festivals we were doing kind of events with authors at the Groucho Club. We were starting to do events at a sort of hotel chain, sort of reader events where I would interview authors. So the opportunity to kind of go out and wave the magazine in people's faces and try and sell subscriptions and build brand awareness and relationships with publishers has been put on a sort of freeze frame. You know, I'm sure it'll come back as soon as the world, you know, builds up its, builds back to sort of normal velocity again. But all that kind of side of the magazine activity has been completely on hold during lockdown.
So have you just got to wait, or are you doing anything differently? Are you using more social media or anything?
Well, it is, yes, I suppose focusing a bit more on social media is, you know, marketing is not my strong suit at all. And I think it's become, you know, pretty clear doing this when thinking about it, that I think there are people who make things and people who sell things. And in that sort of Venn diagram, they rarely overlap. You know, some lucky people are very good at both, but most people are strong at one and weak at the other, and marketing is my weakness. So one of the reasons why I'm able to do Strong Words 7 days a week is because it really captures my imagination, you know. And you can only do something with a great deal of commitment, whether that's making a magazine or running marathons or, you know, building a, you know, some elaborate structure in your garden out of wood or whatever it happens to be. If it really, you know, sets your imagination on fire, that's the only way you can sustain that level of activity. And so because I don't have that level of marketing does not stimulate my imagination, it's hard to find the same commitment. Whereas, you know, it should, I think, be a 50-50 balance between the making of something and the selling of something. And I guess that's why people have business partners. You know, one does one and the other does the other. But in my instance, you know, the marketing doesn't get quite the attention it deserves. And I have a sort of slightly antipathetic attitude towards social media. You know, I find it a bit gormless, and whereas I should be plunging in with great enthusiasm. I find it very easy to find reasons not to do it.
So finally, we ask all our guests for a recommendation of their favourite recent piece of media. It could be a book or a newspaper, paper article. Actually, in your instance, it probably should be a book.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of books I'd like to mention that, you know, the sort of intersection of books and the news at the moment has very much been around lots of people recommending books with some kind of connection to Black Lives Matter and the news in the United States about George Floyd and the protests in this country and so on. So the two books I'd really like to mention that haven't been mentioned as far as I'm aware. One is by an American writer called Jill Leovi, who was wrote for the LA Times for many years, and she wrote a book called Ghetto Side, which is about a drive-by killing in a neighborhood in Los Angeles of a boy who turned out to be the son of a local, of a black policeman who lived locally. And it's a book about the problems of the relationship between the police and the black community in Los Angeles and why there is so much distrust and why the local community finds it so hard to talk to the police. And by the end of it, you realise, well, of course, you know, that it's absolutely not in their interest to do so. And it's a really good exposition of that situation. And then the other book is by a chap called Gilbert King. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner. It actually came out a few years ago, and it's called Devil in the Grove. And it's about an incident in the late 1940s in Florida of appalling racism in which four black men were accused of a crime they had absolutely nothing to do with. In fact, the crime didn't even exist. It was invented. And this then very young lawyer called Thurgood Marshall, who went on to become the first black Supreme Court justice in the United States, he waded into this absolutely appalling situation and tried to do something about it. And if you want a sort of any kind of indication as to just how awful situation was, I mean, this is obviously 70 years ago, but just, you know, the kind of racism that people had to endure, how it took the strength of this one man to, you know, unfortunately he wasn't able to help these individuals involved, but he was able to sort of change the law and shine a light on what people had to put up with. It makes you wonder, you know, well, just how much have things really changed? So it's called The Devil in the Grove, and it's by Gilbert King, and they're both absolutely fabulous true crime books as well, for anybody who likes true crime.
So here are three things that you need to know about our daily newsletter. One, it's a newsletter. Woo. Two, it is amazing.
Woo.
And three, it's daily. Woo. And it's excellent. So if you want to see what all the fuss is about, then please do go to voices.media and sign up. Or we post a link to it every morning at Media Voices Pod on Twitter. So it contains four stories, a link to the podcast, and a link to our Ko-fi page where you can pay
Ko-fi.
To support Ko-fi, where you can pay to support us, help us cover our costs.
And I promise you it's much better than that read through.
I was gonna edit that.
And sadly, our weekly newsletter is no more. If you lived for that weekly newsletter, imagine getting that weekly newsletter five times a week. See previous message.
That's a good deal.
And a very quick shout out. We've now got half of our winners' case studies up for the Publisher Podcast Awards. So again, if you go to voices.media and you go to the analysis section, you can see lessons from award-winning podcasts, The Week Unwrapped.
But until next week, when we'll be back with hopefully less cynicism, a fantastic guest, and another tour through the news for that week. Thanks so much for listening and stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Bye.